Welcome to the podcast series, Blindingly Obvious. My name is Minnie Baragwanath, and this series is based on my book by the same name. Blindingly Obvious is my story. It is a candid and deeply personal story about my life and work as a blind woman, social entrepreneur, and innovator. I wrote it in order to share my experience of blindness with others, and in the hope that it might raise awareness and invite others to actively create a more accessible future, one that is full of possibility. A wonderful voiceover artist and now friend of mine, Romy Hooper, has narrated my full book, all 24 chapters. I do so hope you enjoy listening. It is an absolute pleasure to be able to share it with you.
21. The End of the Dream. The work we had underway, the influence we were having, and the remarkable people we were working with was, for me, as the CEO of this glorious organisation and social change movement, all very much a dream come true. Feeling that people such as Dame Tariana Turia, John Allen, and my amazing team believed in our vision, and yes, I guess also believed in me, was so deeply humbling. This was what with felt like. This was what I had been dreaming of and believing was possible. This was how we could create accessibility social change here in Aotearoa. This was very real, and the dream felt as if it could go on forever. Turning 45 in May 2015, 5 years into the Be Accessible journey, was fairly uneventful for me at the time. I probably did not even mark the occasion. My work was so all-consuming that I had little, if any, bandwidth for anything else. I had, as promised to the universe some years earlier, given myself entirely to the birth of a more accessible Aotearoa. I virtually never saw friends outside of work anymore, or went to dinner, movies, parties, or anything really. Any energy I had to spare went into navigating and running this wonderful, all-consuming, and yes, highly complex entity called B. In many ways, the B team became my friends and my family. We were all very tightly interwoven, and this was part of the magic. I remember one day we invited a dear friend and one of our Fab 50 members to run a workshop with our team. At the end of the professional profiling workshop, Martin informed us that I had a team of the most complex people. He told me they would be a nightmare to manage, but importantly, they were actually the perfect profile for a social change team. Well, that explained a lot. Complexity was our middle name. With all this going on, I did not pay too much attention to an official letter I had received shortly after my birthday. I still had difficulty accessing and reading any mail I received, so I just popped it on a pile of other unopened letters I was gathering to eventually ask my EA to read for me. Eventually, she opened it, then looked at me seriously. Minnie, you need to book a mammogram appointment. Now you're 45, you qualify for the government screening program. I laughed it off and told her I was too busy and that we would get around to that at some later stage. However, the wonderful, amazing, gorgeous Chris ignored my protestations and went ahead and booked me in. Thank God. The mammogram did not seem to be a big deal. Most women of a certain age are very familiar with the cold, metallic, vice-like grip of the mammogram machine, but it is usually all over and done with fairly quickly. As I had no niggling concerns or issues, I left the appointment and really did not give it another thought. Now, fate, synchronicity, grace, whatever you want to call it, can, in my experience, take many forms. Certainly during the early days of Be Accessible, we experienced the most incredible synchronicity, or as we nicknamed it, woo-woo. Money, people, and opportunities all just seemed to appear or open up for us the moment we needed them. It was truly remarkable. We felt utterly blessed, and I think we were. I also now think that fate or synchronicity can come when we need it most, including at times of crisis and life and death. One of our Fab 50 members, Kate, had invited me to speak at a corporate breakfast event for women. It was a fairly common occurrence for me. I would give a 20-minute talk and then answer questions. When I arrived, I was told there was also another speaker, a breast surgeon, who was going to speak after me. As it turned out, this was a very old childhood friend of mine from Palmerston North days, the incredible Erica Winneray Kelly. We had not seen each other since we were about 10 years old. She was now one of Aotearoa's top breast surgeons and absolutely divine. After we had both presented to the breakfast, we took time to chat and catch up as much as we could before leaving to go back to our day jobs. As we turned to leave, I happened to check my phone. During the morning session, I'd received a call from the breast screening clinic saying I needed to come back to the clinic within the next few days. I felt gripped by fear. Why? Why did I need to go back? What did this mean? As Erica climbed into her car, I rushed over to her and told her what had just happened. In her gorgeous, calm, loving way, she reassured me and told me they probably just needed to get a clearer picture. It was probably nothing, but it was important that I go back as soon as possible. We swapped numbers, and she told me to call her at any stage if I was feeling nervous. Talking with Erica and feeling her calm presence helped to settle my nerves, at least for a while. The second visit to the breast clinic was a very different story. This time, they wanted to do all sorts of additional tests. This time, it felt serious. After about an hour of tests, I was in a small dark room receiving an ultrasound on my left breast. As I lay there, trying to keep my mind positive and to keep relaxed, I had a sudden and palpable chilling feeling, as if the barometric pressure in the room had suddenly plummeted. Tentatively, I looked up at the radiologist and asked her if everything was all right. No, she said. It isn't. Time is a very strange thing. At moments of extreme pleasure or extreme danger, it can seem to speed up, slow down, or just disappear altogether. The next week, while I waited for my results, was excruciating. Every moment of the day seemed to take forever. I could think of nothing else but my pending results. It was also during this week that I realized how differently my loved ones would respond to the situation I now found myself in. Some listened calmly. Some told me stories of other people in similar situations to try and reassure me. Others outright rejected the possibility that this could be serious. Still others looked at me with such sadness and concern. Scotty, my younger brother, father of four and serial entrepreneur, by now the founder and CEO of Blue Frog Cereal, came with me to the appointment in Remuera. As we sat in the waiting room with the golden morning sun pouring in the bay window of the renovated old villa, we felt like children again. We were suddenly back at home in our old sun-filled house in Palmerston North, where we had grown up carefree and running wild. We started to get a bit giggly, waves of nervous energy wriggling its way through our bodies. Can you imagine what is going on back there in the office? I said to Scott. They're trying to decide who is the poor person who has the job of telling the blind woman she now has cancer. We laughed. I knew I had cancer. I had known in my soul the moment the room went cold during the ultrasound a week earlier. But it still came as a massive and powerful shock when the specialist said the words out loud. I remember two things that happened in that moment. Firstly, I burst out laughing. The specialist and nurse did look a wee bit surprised. They had kindly placed a box of tissues in front of me, so they'd been expecting tears, and I guess laughter was not so common in these moments. I seem to recall laughing not because this was in any way funny, but simply out of relief and as a release. The waiting, the not knowing, and being suspended in time had been exhausting. Somehow, no matter how bad the results, just knowing felt like a massive relief. I guess some would also call this a shock reaction, and I'm sure that is also true. The second thing that I did was to ask if I could still go on the overseas trip I had coming up in a couple of months' time. I told him I had been selected for an international leadership program being run by the incredible leadership writer and practitioner, the one and only Margaret Wheatley, in America. No, I could not, my specialist said. He said it would be some time before I could go on a trip like that. Somehow this made me sober up. This fact made this new, awful reality start to feel real. I stopped laughing and now I started to cry. Our B board meetings had always had a special quality to them. They'd always felt deeply human, full of honesty, passion, and laughter. The last meeting that we all had together before I left to have my surgery and begin my treatment was particularly special. I remember the room was full of such care, such kindness. I felt so deeply loved, and I felt such love for my team and board. None of us knew that day I left that it would be 12 long months before we would all come back together again in that room. Neither I nor B would ever be the same again. During my appointment with the specialist in Remuera, they had handed me a folder full of critical information I needed to know about breast cancer. Key medical facts, key contact information, and support groups. Or at least I think that is what was in that precious folder. Of course, I was unable to read it. I could not see it. Sadly, it was pretty much of no use to me. It was at this point that a terrible realization started to dawn on me. I was not just about to go through breast cancer. I was about to go through it as a blind woman, in a health system that was deeply inaccessible. If the information I would need to navigate this upcoming crisis was basically inaccessible to me, how on earth was I going to manage? This was the tip of one truly horrendous and enormous iceberg. Although I still lived alone at this point, I had at least moved out of my previous topsy-turvy home and into a lovely new place just 400 meters away from the old one. It was a gorgeous little townhouse with its own outdoor courtyard and full of sunshine too. I loved it and felt totally secure here, but I did not have someone at my side to just be my eyes when I now needed them most. A question I have often pondered is how many times is too many times to ask for help when you need it? Do we each have an allocation of how many times we can ask for assistance? Do we each have a quota of how many times we are willing to respond to someone who needs assistance? Can we ask 20 times in 1 month? Or do we need to spread this out across a lifetime? What are the rules? What are the expectations? Generally speaking, are we more willing to give to those in our family, those close to us? And why is this? What if, for some reason, perhaps just the cards we are dealt, or fate, we do not fit this expectation and these unspoken rules? What happens then, and who is keeping score? For someone such as myself, for whom the thought of being a burden is such an anathema, realizing that I would need to ask for help was very confronting and eye-opening in many, many ways. I guess the question here was, who would be with me? Who would walk with me throughout this wild rollercoaster ride? Who would show up? And how would they show up? And would I let them? My mastectomy and reconstruction surgery were scheduled for the 31st of September, 2015. Afterwards, no one and nothing could have prepared me for how I felt when I came to. I shook violently from head to toe. An uncontrollable spasm seized my entire being. Yes, I must have been hit by a train. Nothing else could explain this truly terrible feeling. I'd been cut open, cut apart, sliced into pieces and rebuilt. It was brutal. The trauma and the shock throughout my body was unrelenting. This was something other than pain. I was now in hell and there was absolutely no way out. Scotty was sitting there beside me when I came to. The only part of my entire body I felt I could move was the little finger on my left hand. I slowly wiggled it for him, signaling I wanted him to touch it. He took this tiny, fragile offering and held onto it with his gentle, giant hands. I will never forget this delicate love. For the first few days, I was monitored very closely. Nurses and doctors checked my wounds every couple of hours, day and night. The concern was whether the reconstructed breast would take. If it did not, I would be rushed back into surgery. I prayed it would be okay. I never wanted to go near surgery again as long as I lived. I was now existing in a very surreal time warp, where simply surviving felt like a huge achievement. I was a shell of my former self. My darling cousin Paul came and visited me. I remember he stayed a night in the lazy boy chair beside my bed. How sweet. How kind. How generous of him to do this. he was with me. Like so many of the men in my family, Paul is over 6 feet tall, and as it turns out, not really designed to fit a standard lazy boy chair. We both awoke one night to find he had totally tipped the chair up and was now sprawled on the floor. We laughed glorious golden laughter. Thank God. This was like a tiny glimpse of light. This was a tiny glimpse of normality and of the possibility things just might get better. Mum came in every day. She sat with me, read to me, nursed me. I now knew how incredibly lucky her patients had been to have had her as their nurse all those years before. I now felt the power of her love and deep care. There is nothing that compares to the fierce love of a mother when her child, even her grown-up child, is under threat. She gave everything to me. The day came when the doctor decided I was finally able to go home, although I didn't believe I was well enough. The first night, Mum and I stayed at my dear friend Q's house. She had a downstairs bedroom and bathroom I could use, unlike my own home at the time. But even before I was sent home, I had tried repeatedly to tell the doctors and nurses that I felt something was very wrong. Being the super sensor that I am, I could actually smell a strange odor coming from the wound under my arm. I was repeatedly ignored. The next day, I collapsed at Q's house. The ambulance came and rushed me back to the hospital. I had a massive infection throughout my entire system. It took days to identify what it was and which antibiotic I needed to treat it. I stayed in hospital for another week recovering. Again, the time came to send me home. This time it took less than a week for me to be rushed back to hospital. I was having increasing trouble breathing. I also had the most excruciating pain up into my shoulder and neck, and nothing would alleviate or soothe it. My lung had collapsed. I had pneumonia. After a week back in hospital, the time came again to send me home. I protested. I insisted that something was still very wrong. I could still feel this sharp pain in my neck and shoulder. I was dismissed. I was ignored and sent home. This time, another week went by. I felt terribly weak, terribly unwell, and I felt I was getting worse. My GP's practice was just across the road from my home, about 400 meters away. It seemed crazy to order a taxi. I decided to walk there, even though I had not been able to walk more than a few meters at a time for weeks now. As soon as my doctor laid eyes on me, she said, "I think you have a blood clot on your lungs. I think you have a pulmonary embolism. You must go to the hospital immediately." This time, when the doctor in the hospital confirmed that I had multiple clots throughout my lungs, I cried desperately. This time I broke down. This was too much. I knew how serious a PE can be. A darling friend's father had just died of one a week before. When would this relentless bombardment of my body and soul all stop? What more could possibly go wrong? Then the day came for my follow-up appointment with my cancer specialist back at the hospital. They now had the results from my surgery and had some further heartbreaking news for me. Initially, they had not thought the cancer had spread. They thought it had been contained within the breast tissue. However, this was not the case anymore. They had found cancer in my lymph nodes after all. They wanted me to have chemotherapy. They wanted me to have radiation treatment. And they wanted me to do hormone treatment. But there was a problem. The wound on my stomach from where they had taken the tissue to remake the breast was not healing. We could not do the chemotherapy with an open wound like that. The wound did not heal for 6 months. When it finally did heal, another very strange thing happened. The sutures under my skin started to come out. I had bright blue sutures poking out of my stomach. One piece was 2 centimeters long, and it was coming from deep within me. Someone had used the wrong sutures. Instead of dissolving sutures, they had used the undissolving ones. The decision was eventually made to go back in, have more surgery and redo the suturing. I eventually decided, if you can call it that, to just go ahead with the radiation treatment. We had missed the optimum time for chemo due to the issues with my wound, and we were nervous that the side effects of the hormone treatment might further reduce my eyesight. And I had no more fight left in me. By now, having radiation treatment was all I could face. I was still injecting myself every day in the thigh for my blood clots, and still very, very unwell. During these weeks and months when I travelled back and forth to the hospital, my collection of medication, lotions, potions, and drugs was growing extensively beside my bed at home. The issue, however, was that, of course, I could not read any of them. They all lived in tiny bottles with tiny printed words on them. They were basically illegible to me. Eventually, I developed my own system. I drew large black felt-tip letters on the top of each bottle, a kind of mini-code that I could use to know which was which. I then lined them up in the exact order I needed to take them throughout the day and night, and I hoped like hell that I didn't muddle them. The other thing that was now becoming a real issue for me was keeping track of my multiple appointments. With all the various conditions I was now dealing with, I had appointments with multiple specialists and parts of the health system. Keeping track of all the letters and all the appointments was almost impossible. And of course, they were all illegible to me. They were virtually all inaccessible. It was a nightmare trying to keep on top of all of this. My treatment also spanned across multiple health boards, and there was zero coordination between them. I regularly had appointments booked on the same day at the same time in different hospitals, due to this lack of coordination. What a terrible mess. For a while there, I was juggling appointments with my cancer specialist, my breast surgeon, my radiotherapy specialist, my lung specialist, my blood clot specialist, and many others too. All the way through my health experience, I was repeatedly told about the possibility of side effects. I was told the risks and told that they were unlikely, that most people did not experience these types of issues. However, it soon became clear that I was without a doubt an outlier. I rarely, if ever, seemed to fit inside the bell curve of normal. I became obsessed with this concept. How much of our world was designed for some notion of average or normal? What happens to all of those people who never fit this narrow definition? Does anyone fit this narrow sense of average? I obsessed with the cold, hard reality that our health system was deeply inaccessible and had been designed for people without impairments. How ironic. And I felt deeply confronted by the fact that this time, the consequence of being inaccessible could actually mean life or death. I started to reflect long and hard on our work at Be Accessible. I started to think about the pace of social change in Aotearoa. I started to ask myself, what else did we, need to do to turn this awful situation around forever? Was it even possible at all to create an accessible future? Was there another way to look at all this? What was actually possible?
I do so hope you enjoyed listening to my book and podcast series, Blindingly Obvious. It has been an absolute privilege to be able to share this with you. Listen out for the next chapter coming soon. If you would like to purchase the entire book in audio or an array of other accessible formats, including New Zealand Sign Language, or to learn more about my work, visit my website, minib.co.nz. Thank you for taking the time to listen and to be with me. See you next time. With love, Minnie B.